Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
Hello, and welcome to Bookworm from KCRW. My guest today is a writer that I've wanted to talk to for, more than 20 years, and somehow he has slipped through the cracks. Now he has a new novel. It is Scott Spencer. The novel is An Ocean Without a Shore. I personally feel it's the book for the time we're living in. Inadvertently, he's written the book for a person who was suffering the solitude of a pandemic. The narrator is a man nicknamed Kip. His real name is Christopher. And he discovers that he has lived his whole life in quarantine. Can you tell me about that, Scott?
Yes, and first of all, thanks, Michael. It's great to hear your voice. Kip is in a kind of self-imposed prison because he is in love with his best friend, but he's not out to his best friend and he's not out to anybody. And he sort of maintains this social distance, hoping that something will happen that will change everything and that his dream of this long unrequited love will suddenly be his, and it just goes on and on and on. Once he spends a year and then 2 years not being open to his friend about his sexuality, it just becomes more and more difficult to get out of it. And before he knows it, decades go by, and he's still in the same situation, still waiting for something to happen, still, in fact, waiting for his life to begin.
He suspects, and I suspect that his suspicion is true, that there are many others like him who never came out of the closet, who have lived a life of restraint and lying. Many of the people reading the book say, this is not a character for our age, but restraint, fear, desperation are qualities that exist in all ages. Just because there was gay pride doesn't mean that all gay people were able to march forth. And this is a novel about a person who found himself in the prison of deception. What made you interested in this extraordinary character?
He grew on me. I wanted him to narrate this book because I was really interested in seeing Thaddeus, who had been in a previous book of mine. I was interested in seeing him from a different angle. And I at first thought that that Kip would be a kind of, Nick Carraway type of narrator who is there and not there. But once I began writing in his voice, I became more and more involved with him and attached to him, and it really became his story. Not telling the truth about yourself is something that we all cope with to one degree or another, and it's something that I've personally struggled with, not so much in terms of my sexuality, but other aspects of me that I felt shame about and wanted to somehow shift or move or spin in such a way that I would be accepted in the world that I lived in. So that sort of deception interests me, and it also seems to me very, very dramatic. And I'm also interested in people who are a little bit left behind by history. And Kip is very left behind by history. Kip is living in the post-Stonewall world, but can't be a part of it.
Well, Scott Spencer, I would say that just about every gay person has, at some point of his trajectory or another, has got to get over a love, a deep love, for a best friend who is not gay. This happens, and it happens, and it happens again. Sometimes people give up years of their lives to it. Most of us, thank goodness, survive to find love in an unhidden circumstance with someone who, as Kip says, you can read the Sunday paper with, you can pass the food across the table. In fact, toward the end of the book, there's something magnificent happens. He gets to say to his friend Thaddeus, I love you, and I don't just love you. I love you all the time. I love you, and I love you, and I love you. And there's nothing about you that I don't love. He actually manages to say this, and this book, in a sense, is leading to the consequences of that confession. I want you to hear the extraordinary passage, because suddenly Kip is beating Thaddeus with a suitcase. Kip is a stock market person, and the suitcase is full of secret documents that would constitute insider trading, and Thaddeus is needy. And Kip discovers Thaddeus attempting to look in that suitcase. And here we are toward the end of Scott Spencer's An Ocean Without a Shore.
And yet, as if to cushion the blow, when the free fall was complete and I hit the ground naked and unmasked, memories did flood in. It was like an infusion of an anesthetic, lessening the terror. Maybe that's why we are deluged with senses from our life as it ends, to distract us from contemplating what's coming next. Whatever the cause, there I was, sobbing in Dr. Wessler's office, grabbing tissue after tissue, and there I was, leaving Morris and Robbie's apartment and lingering at the door after they closed it behind me and hearing Robbie call out to Morris, "Honey, can you come here for a sec?" Soothing myself in bed with the scent of Pinot Silvestre rising up from the sheets. Like so many of the things we do when we are unobserved, there was something small and embarrassing in pretending that bottled scent was somehow Thaddeus, hoping only to drain desire out of myself as if it were an infection. But I knew I was but one of many. I knew as the day broke, there were millions, more or less, like me, waking up alone or next to the wrong person. I have learned one of the lessons of loneliness, one of its shocking side effects. When you are in a state of longing, desire goes on and on like an ocean without a shore. So there I was on a flight to Denver, sitting two rows behind a man who from the back looked quite a bit like Thaddeus, his height, his build, the slope of his skull, and spending 4 airborne hours convinced it was Thaddeus, yet not once getting up to make sure because I wanted to preserve the fantasy. Don't awaken me. Let me dream. Love like mine is really just a dream. And here is what Aristotle says. In dreams, the element of judgment is absent, but the morning always arrives. Here it comes, step by step. The pitiless jailer comes closer to inspect your cell. The horrible mornings, all of them compressed into one scented pillow flung blindly across one room, whether it was in Ann Arbor or New York or Denver or San Francisco or Athens or Key Biscayne. Okay, important to note what I did not allow myself to do. I did not subject another human being to my obsession. I knew I was unavailable, and I never allowed anyone to think otherwise. No one wasted their love on me or their time. No human placebo for me. I did not want one person to stand in for the person I really wanted. I did not stoop to convenience. And as to Thaddeus, I restrained myself, even if it meant breaking my own spirit. I did not stalk. I did not peek and hide. And I did not beg. I did not dial the phone just to hear his voice. When we dined together, I did not order the second bottle of wine so he'd miss the train to Leyden. I did not bury my face in the sheets of the bed he slept in. When I was alone in his house, I did not scour the premises looking for secrets, and I did not try to sow discontent in his married life. In fact, I tried to help him shore things up. I only wanted what was best for him.
This is Scott Spencer reading from An Ocean Without a Shore. When you get to the end of what you just read, you say, I only wanted what was best for him. And this is frequently the thing that parents say about their children to justify all sorts of parental harshness, strictness, and even neglect. And in this book, the influence of parents is enormous. And in particular, Thaddeus has had parents who've been so indifferent to his need for loving gratification that Thaddeus, the man that Kip, the narrator, is in love with, has become a performer. He always needs applause. He's not in charge of the terrible need he has for gratitude. And Kip, too, is the kind of person who only wants what's best for you, which is not a way to live. Eventually, we need to learn to want what's best for ourselves. Bits of selfishness have to creep in, or we don't become human, huh?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And it's totally right about Thaddeus, of course, because Thaddeus is in some ways empty, left to his own devices. So you have to keep on putting something into him for him to feel that he's okay. He's a house of cards. His only way of standing is from the regard from other people. And Kip knows that, and rather than being irritated by it, it actually touches him because he understands its source, that Thaddeus's parents lost the child. They withdrew emotionally. The more they withdrew from him, the more he would try to like crazily entertain them, even going so far as singing and dancing for them at the dinner table, just like a puppet for them. And these things might be warnings to other people. And for Kip, he took it in stride, and it made him feel closer to Thaddeus. And in a way, it seemed to me that Kip was using Thaddeus's unavailability as a way of keeping himself in check.
Well, I think An Ocean Without a Shore, which I read with true absorption, is a book in which you discover characters, all of whom need something like a truly great therapist. These are characters who are suffering from childhood wounds that have never healed, and the idea that they don't have to heal is something that the book, in a sense, takes into consideration. If you do not heal your wounds, you will be walking wounded for the rest of your life. And that leads to constantly destructive behavior toward the self and toward others.
Yes, yes. It's a hard lesson to learn.
Oh, it's awful. Now, what's beautiful about an ocean without a shore is I read it, and then I read the novel that came before it, which is called River Under the Road. It's a novel that uses many of the characters in Ocean Without a Shore, but from a different perspective. But tell me, can it be possible that the author of Endless Love, which, you'll pardon me, I believe is one of the extraordinary books of American literature and still is, in that book, there's a 35-page love sequence that does what Norman Mailer was only trying to do in the time of her time. It's the most magnificent sex scene in the former centuries American literature. Still astounding. Still beautiful. Do you yearn for that kind of peak another time?
I'm glad that I was able to do it when that was the right thing for me to be doing. What I could do then was bring the full force of my youthful passion and enthusiasm and newness to the world into my writing. And if I hadn't been able to find the time to write that then it would never have been written. Because every age has its own thing that it wants to express, and its own knowledge, its own experience, its own wounds. So I'm not really interested in writing a young person's book. I'm interested in writing books that reflect what I've learned, because now I'm 75 almost, and I know a lot that I didn't know then, and I've probably forgotten things that I did know then.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Scott Spencer about his new novel, An Ocean Without a Shore. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Scott Spencer about his new novel, An Ocean Without a Shore, which portrays a life-shaping sense of frustrated yearning. You know, Flaubert called Madame Bovary a book in which nothing happens. This, in its own way, is a book in which, because of yearning and frustration, nothing can happen. But that certainly is what it feels like to be at home during this quarantine, to be facing aborted impulses, desires that can't be fulfilled or only imaginatively enacted. It must have been fascinating, Scott, to work on a novel in which so much desire is buried under the carpet.
It was, you know, every book has its own degree of difficulty, its own puzzle to solve. And my puzzle to solve here was how to write a book in which, you know, love basically is unconsummated, and it's a book about being sidelined. How do you keep that something that somebody would want to read, or could even was even possible to read it? So how do you keep any narrative momentum going when the characters themselves are stuck, as you say? And so you find incidents that propel the novel forward, even as the characters are scrambling, really scrambling to stay in place.
Part of the strength of this book comes from what I know to be the fact that you were teaching writing in prison. Mm-hmm. Now, you've written a whole book in which the narrator confesses that he is a prisoner of his own nature. But by the end of the book, he is ready to say, pass me the newspaper, please. So the great thing about An Ocean Without a Shore by my guest Scott Spencer is that you get to wake up with Kip, the character, and see that everything around him was a misassessment. What's fascinating is from the very beginning, Thaddeus has been casually willing to express that he too has had an interest in men. It was Kip's need for secrecy and silence that prevented him from investigating many of the things said around him. He's like someone who chooses prison. Yes?
Yes, yes, you're absolutely right. It's, you know, he's basically ashamed of himself and is really feels safe in a world in which he can have the fullness that you feel when you desire somebody and the fullness that you feel when you can imagine what it would be like if only. But you don't have to step outside of that privacy, the privacy of your inner life, and test that against the real world and be actually rejected or hurt or disappointed or bored or all the things that can happen to you when your love is actual and actually out in the world.
I know that it's not presently on your intentions list, but I know that once upon a time you spoke to an interviewer about this being a trilogy. Could you ever imagine writing a novel in which you reward Kip with an ordinary life?
I could imagine it. Yes, because, you know, it's my arrogance that makes me think I can imagine almost anything. It doesn't really strike me as that exciting to, you know, talk about his ordinary life, but since I really like writing about characters in extremis, I don't know if this is going to be a trilogy, and if it ever does become a trilogy, it's not going to focus on Kip or Thaddeus. It'll probably focus on the four kids in this book and yank them forward 20 years and see what the world is like.
Well, one of them, Hannah, is absolutely extraordinary. I found every time she appeared, I found an innate heart sympathy going in her direction because inadvertently, oh dear, you've given her a mother as harsh as Thaddeus's own mother had been. This is about the trauma of excess donut holes, the trauma of having a daughter who's growing up heavy. And she's a lovely girl who needs to be able to escape the terrible vigilance of a mother who herself has not received the attention she dreamed of.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as you said before, Grace thinks that she's doing it for the kids' own good because, you know, oh, you're going to be so unhappy. You're going to miss out on so much. And she basically creates a mini reign of terror on the subject of food.
I knew a girl who was growing up heavy who went and spent a year during her late teens in Paris. And she came home to America, still heavy, but so fashionable and so alert to interactions and so, may I say it, beautiful, a pleasure to be with. She invented her own style, which, you'll pardon me, is what every writer does. We begin if we begin by feeling ugly and we work our personal style into a sense of beauty, even the beauty of being in extremis.
Oh, that's wonderful, Michael. That's really wonderful. Well, I love Nima, and I would like to write about her again, but it's not next for me. I've got to take a break from these novels.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you at last, Scott. I've wanted to do it for many, many years. Welcome to Bookworm. Scott Spencer is the author of An Ocean Without a Shore. It's published by Echo HarperCollins. That means you know Daniel, don't you?
Yes, I do. He's my editor.
At a certain period of our lives, he came to visit the Poetry Room at the State University of New York at Buffalo. He was looking for the short stories written by Weldon Keyes. At that time, he was still editing a magnificent literary magazine called Antaeus. Since those years, he's joined HarperCollins. He's become your editor, Joyce Carol Oates' editor. He's edited a good deal of What's Worth Reading in American Fiction. And it's my pleasure to be able to salute Daniel Halpern and Scott Spencer. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks a lot, Michael. This has been wonderful.
You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. I'm very proud to say that we're on twice a week in Berlin. Special thanks to co-producer Sean Sullivan, associate producer Alan Howard, and technical director Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Join me again next time on Bookworm when Alex Halberstadt is our guest.